going to say is not necessarily the theory of Ray Johnson, or I would not like to present it as that, but an aspect of his work that has been vital to my interest in him. And then I think a lot of other researchers will have other perspectives. And the title of my lecture, it's "Every Letter I Write Is Not a Love Letter." And that is a quote from Ray Johnson. And the subtitle I want to give it is "Inventing Sociality with Ray Johnson's Postal System." Now, what does that mean? If any one tendency could be said to have marked art of the last decade, it would surely be the return of the notion of the social as a kind of master trope for critical art practices. So there is an increasing number of works that are conceived and performed and received within a framework that describes artworks primarily in terms of the social relations they engender or operate within. And the essence of this shift is, I think, very much a certain literalist impulse that somehow guarantees that this perspective, this socialist perspective, does not remain at the level of conceptual analysis only. And by that I mean a kind of sociological form of analysis that encircles an object that has already been defined as aesthetic. But it's rather an approach that is performed as the very content of artworks themselves. So in a very real sense, such works may provide what you could call, with certain sociologists, a reflexive methodology, in that they serve to objectify, to show us the relations between persons, groups, institutions that get involved with them, deploying social rather than primarily visual technologies, and engendering social rather than primarily visual scenarios or projections. And to some extent, you could see Ray Johnson's work operating on this level. However, and this is very important to me, a different approach, I think, emerges, a different approach to the social emerges once one really pays attention to the very idiosyncratic performance, postal performance of Ray Johnson's work. And Ray Johnson was, as maybe of you, many of you maybe know by now, the perhaps the inventor of the so-called mail art network. He was using the postal system as an artistic medium, and through his approach, with the social, with the postal system, I think his take on art and sociality was less focused on telling us about social relations, objectifying social relations, than on inventing sociality in a new way. And how can we understand that? I'll try best as I can to explain my theory around that. But I want to start with this example we have here, and I just want to read this little text aloud because it's an important text. It says, "One of the worst days in my life. I went down for mail, and in the box were two thin postcards and a letter to Jeremy Anderson, the Alexa Gallery, San Francisco, that's been kicking around, stamped insufficient address since September 1964, Sayville, Cherry Grove, and San Francisco, February 1965. One postcard was from Lila Goodman, saying there's hope and a separate cover, something is arriving for me. Other postcard is the third I have received this week from Something Else Press about my own book, Paper Snake. The other two postcards from them were to other people care of me. It was almost like receiving no mail at all to receive these three items. There are days like holidays or Sundays when there is no mail delivery and the box doesn't function. But that's very philosophical. I think I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter." Now, on this worst of all days, August 8, 1965, the American artist Ray Johnson, seeking to connect with the outside world, gets nothing but futile returns and dead ends. So his mailbox is not exactly empty, but it might as well have been. All he found was misplaced mail, announcements for possible future mailings, redundant mail, mail to other people. So as his status and function then as a proper addressee then appeared to be somewhat in doubt, self-addressing, writing a letter to himself, seemed to be the only option left. The disappointment of that particular day, which I think can hardly have been all that different from the possible disappointment of, say, June 13, 1963, or September 29, 1964, just to pick some random dates, is in fact a direct effect of the promise of the modern postal system. And the promise of the modern postal system, that's expressed very beautifully, and I don't have a photo of that, on the inscription what that was on the building of the former Washington, D.C. City Post Office, but I've written it down here so you can read it. It writes about the postal system: messenger of sympathy and love, servant of parted friends, consoler of the lonely, bond of scattered family, enlarger of common life, carrier of news and knowledge, instrument of trade and industry, promoter of mutual acquaintance and of peace and goodwill among men and nations. So that's a lot of things to promise for the postal system. And you can find this promise also emerging again and again throughout popular culture, not at least in pop songs. And if I was a really good singer, I would sing these songs too, but I won't, and I think you know them. The Letter and Please Mr. Postman, Sealed with a Kiss, Signed, Sealed, Delivered, and Return to Sender, just to mention a few songs that somehow translate the question of love and connection through the metaphor of the postal system. So all these promises have to do with a promise of a type of connectedness that transcends the daily experience that we all have of social division. It promises a type of ecstatic, boundless togetherness for which the correct name is either utopia or just love. But for all the heartfelt pathos of all these promises, this notion of boundless togetherness is, as the German philologist Bernard Siegert argues, mainly the product of a feverish circulation of communications that masks, in fact, the power relations created and maintained by the modern postal system. So, in fact, the modern postal system that appeared only towards the end of the 18th century is primarily a technology of control, engineering, control engineering that characterizes modern government. The postal system emerges with modern form of government, of democracies as we know them today. And it could be seen as a surveillance instrument designed to tie all parts of nation states together in one postal empire. So that's the other side of the postal system. And as it happened, this postal empire soon became a kind of self-regulating network of connections that were, so to speak, existing beyond or above the actual physical distances of the territories that it traversed. So the postal system then belongs to a mode of government, of political governing, that designed its subjects, the subjects of the modern state, as subjects of the mailing system. That is, as addressees, potential senders and receivers. And there's something very important and new that happens when the postal system is really developed with a modern state. Everybody now has to have an address and a mailbox. You didn't have that before. That's a new thing, that everybody is a sender and receiver and has an address and a mailbox. And this means, very importantly, that you identify yourself as a potential writer and a potential reader. And on this identification rests both the idea of individual authorship, I as an author who writes and so on, and also a new conception of literature as an extension of letter writing, that the novel and so on, the form of the novel, is essentially an extension of the idea of writing a letter. That's quite important. So it's the idea of literature as a kind of transmission that reaches out from one soul to another, never missing its true destination, which is always the inner person, the real being, the true individual, the addressee. And good government in this type of state that we all live with still ensures that the post will be delivered. That's very important. That things will be delivered physically, but more importantly, that things will not lose their proper meaning. This is the discursive configuration of a postal society in which the function of letters and literature is less that of communication than of assigning positions. For instance, the position of the sexes, positioning men as writing beings and women as reading and understanding beings. That was one idea. But most importantly, I think, is the idea of a sort of feverish imagination almost of a perfect hermeneutic circle of sending and receiving and understanding that remains really central here. So the postal system is the essential scenario of romantic love covering up a scenario of control and good government. So this is what we're all living with. Now, to this ecstatic scenario could be added the fact that the circulation of letters implied not only a hermeneutics, but even more importantly, an erotics. For letters are not just messages, they are also bodies. And here I think is a wonderful letter body by Ray Johnson. They are bodies that connect or fail to connect with other bodies. You know all, I think, the trope of dead letters and the existence, in the US at least, of the so-called dead letter office, where unreturnable mail goes to die, and so on. So, and this idea that letters can be dead attests to this imagination of letters as somehow bodies. But the pathos of dead letters, it's not just that two persons fail to exchange signs or meanings, but that actual mortal beings, bodies, miss getting in touch. So letters that fail to communicate are like dead bodies, corpses. Letters are not just neutral carriers of spiritual content, meaning content. They are material bodies, and you know the letters sprayed with perfume, hiding locks of hair, flowers, all these things. They are charged with the drama of erotic contact. So now I think you can all see the full dramatic implications of all those unfortunate postal events on August 8, 1965. The promise of a connection, at once spiritual and physical erotic, had been frustrated for Ray Johnson. And what other forms of contact are there? You're disconnected from the physical and spiritual connection. However, the conclusion of Ray Johnson's little report on these unfortunate events attests, I think, above all, to a purely systemic or technological operation that's a direct characteristic of the postal system. The option to self-address, to write himself a letter, I think essentially confirms Ray Johnson's position within the discursive field of senders and receivers. The postal system, a series of operations that precede, in many ways, the category of meaning, simply works. It's there, it works, disregarding of the success or failure of communication. It's just there. So Johnson's desires may have been frustrated, but he's still connected. So this diary-like little report, itself a kind of letter to himself, I think, confirms this essential connectedness, as well as the fact that there is, apparently, no escaping the postal regime. You're always connected, if only just with yourself. Even the disconnection is a form of connection. The postal system is there. It's our condition. Now, it's very important to contextualize all of this. And I think it's important to say that the drama of Ray Johnson's postal connection, it's played out not in the context of romantic literature or education. It's played out within a modern mediascape, connected to a very different mode of artistic production. And this is a mode of artistic production for which the postal system is not the silent vehicle that orders reality, as it might have been, I guess, in the 19th century, but a highly visible and autonomous, almost, media technology by means of which some of the most central tenets or strategies of 20th century artistic imaginations are continually probed or tested. And I think that, in a sense, all Ray Johnson does during the course of an obstinately eccentric artistic career that spans more than 40 years is to make literal, to so to speak materialize, to show us the centrality of this media technology, the postal system, the centrality of this media technology to the new forms of self-reflection within the field of visual arts. By shaping his entire practice as a postal system, he seems to make literal, in a sense, the way in which this media technology has become a sort of framework by means of which art can rework its status as a particular pertinent case of postal communication, the harbinger of either social utopia or love, or both. He quite simply presents, in fact, the postal system as the framework that allows modern art to articulate its desires to inscribe itself as concretely as possible in the social, with all the ambivalences that these desires entail. And I'm really talking about 20th century avant-garde art and its continual discussions about its position in relation to social community, social collectives, and so on. Now, initially, these articulations appear in terms of what could be, at the outset, be seen to be a specifically visual space or format, notably the space of collages. Within the field of visual arts, collages constitute a space where the very materiality of artistic communications or media technologies are foregrounded. So, in fact, Ray Johnson seems to play off the fact that the bits and scraps of modernist collages often consist of various kinds of postal dispatches, stamped and addressed envelopes, newspaper clippings, banknotes, money, checks, calling cards, etc. And I think the newspaper clippings that you will find in synthetic cubism are maybe some of the first or most famous cases in point. And I think that Ray Johnson, or I know that Ray Johnson once told James Rosenquist that his work was essentially an extension of cubism because he put things in the mail and they got spread all over the place. That was his reading of cubism, this idea of spreading collages as a distribution principle. But if the postal system takes on a certain presence within the space of collage, this is related to the fact, I think, that the question of the materiality of artistic media is now raised to a principle due to the fact that the question, that due to the presence of new communications technologies that all highlight the very materiality of communications. This is a topic that is highlighted very much with the Dada movements and the constructivist movements. And you can see it very much in, for instance, the letters and postcards that find their way into the collages and photomontages of the Dada movement, as seen here in a collage by Schwitters. There's a connection made here between collages, the postal system, and media technologies. So here the postal reference place along with the tendency to imagine new modes of artistic production and reception in terms of technologies such as gramophony, film, photography, radio, and the telegraph, and so on. I'm just giving you a little Dada image here, the Dada phone, so part of this whole realm of articulation. So collages were identified with media technologies in general. Collages, Dada collages, constructivist collages, were identified with media
communications media in general. But this identification was formulated from a postal perspective that at one point had the Dada movement describe itself as a postal stamp. So Dada did in fact identify itself quite specifically with the automatization and anonymization of the postal system that took place in 1847. Because that in 1847 was the year when they invented the postal stamp. That's very important. And that allowed for prepaid mail to be stuffed in communal street letterboxes by masses of anonymous writers. Before, you had to go to the postal office, small cities, everybody's controlling who's sending what to whom, and often the postal officials would open your letters and control the contents. With prepaid stamps, you were guaranteed anonymity and a sort of private life, and the whole system then become a sort of autonomous and automatic operation. So that's a quite radical event in the history of postal systems. So here, when Dada identifies itself as a postal stamp, this avant-garde movement explicitly presents the systemic nature of communication technologies as its own productive framework. We are the postal system, we are the automaton. This is what they're saying. Now, the presence of this framework, I think, was only made explicit at the moment when Ray Johnson started to use collage strategies as the basis for what would seem to be a social practice, a community practice, in the most concrete sense of the word. In fact, from 1955 onwards, he managed to create a functioning, real international postal network of hundreds of active senders and receivers by starting to send works of art, mostly small collages or dispersed bits of pieces that could be read in terms of a sort of collage aesthetic, to send these to a list of recipients in the mail. And here's an image of a meeting that he imagined would take place for some members of his postal system, his private postal system. So as the network started to grow, gradually engaging all its participants as both senders and receivers, the notion of an endless collage activity informed the whole of this work. From the contents of mailings, as you've seen in these earlier images I've shown you, to the notion of disseminating messages more or less at random. And in the course of the 1970s and 1980s, this network developed into what became known gradually as the International Mail Art Movement, a system of exchanges that far exceeded Johnson's sphere of influence. And of course, the manifest social dimension of this project would seem all the more convincing with the withdrawal of any one master, creator, or master signature, or what will you. So the mail art movement simply seemed to have been made real, the old dream of social utopia, a social utopia modeled on artistic exchanges. And there are many examples in artistic practice of the 20th century that you somehow can create a new and better society if you use artistic creation as a model for how society should work. Joseph Beuys, for instance, was an artist who was thinking in these terms. So it's a rather widespread idea, this. So the postal system, it seems to be a media technology that makes this social artistic utopia possible, on a level at once theoretical and practical. But what actually happened here, and this I want to emphasize very much, is something more complicated and something not so necessarily nice. What actually happened here was that the essential duplicity of the modern postal system, where the new freedom of individual authorship is primarily also a function of regulation, control, etc., was collapsed into one single positive framework, a framework that presented its loving circle of exchanges and it's control engineering as part of the same logic or operation. So it seemed as if the use of the postal system within the sphere of visual art is first and foremost served to directly transfer the romantic discourse of understanding from this kind of aesthetic, ecstatic and ephemeral realm of souls and interiorities to the more grounded realm of social organization or governing. And the problems with this can be traced very, very soon when you look at how the actual international male art movement operated. It's very duplicitous. And I want to make a change here about how the male art system functioned or was supposed to function by a statement by John Held Jr. I think that slide is a bit bad. He said, "Male art is changing the way we think about art and about living in the world. After decades of erecting a worldwide structure of global interaction, male art, and now email art, continues to evolve as a stimulus for increased understanding and cooperation among a global constituency." So you see here the conflation of the ideal of ecstatic togetherness with the notion of actual here and now sociality. It necessarily calls for its own particular mode of not so overt control engineering. For the agreed upon principle of the international male art movement, its social contract, in fact, displays all the problems and double binds that mark any attempt to organize utopia in actual social space. Something you can see from Soviet states or from smaller attempts at community living in the 70s and so on. Each and every one of its techniques to engender the new forms of social unity or love or utopia expresses a desire to be released from the ordinary constraints of power relations, and particularly the power relations of the international art system with its galleries and museums and famous artists and not so famous artists and so on. But the implementation of such freedom was in fact based on a very closely policed system of ethical rules that essentially expressed the fear of a all too likely fall from grace. So it engaged in the principles of the male art system was to engage with a number of musts and must nots do. You should not judge the mailings of other people. You should get rid of your vanity as an individual author. You should try not to think of a work after you have sent it. You should not expect returns. So to be a good male artist, you would have to behave like a saint, in fact. You would have to get rid of yourself. So you had to continually police yourself to operate within this system, strict system of rules. So in the social contract of the male art participants, this ethics of ego denial is rooted in the central principles that any object received through the mail should be received guilt-free, with no reply expected. Exhibitions of male art should entail no fees, no juries, and no rejection. And finally, you should work in the assumption that all senders receive. So it's a very Christian thing going on here, I think. The central idea here is that of a free give, that a gift is not something where you should expect to return, a free give. And that is a response to the evident fact that in the modern art system of galleries and museums, that system makes a very interesting case for the study of social antagonism or social division. With all the fears you have in this system of feeling inferior due to comparison and competition, and also, of course, the idea that everything has a sales price. Nothing is for free, in fact. It's a kind of Oedipal scenario, a conflict scenario that is deeply ingrained in art school teaching, in fact, within our whole dealing with the idea of becoming an artist or relating to art. So, I mean, it's just central in the idea that not everybody is allowed to be an artist, right? And only the product of certain artists, those said to measure up to art's history, are accorded high value. Male art, in contrast, not only attempted to sanction the free reception of gifts without any obligation, so no price, no, nothing like that, and in sense to restore the symbolical division between gift and exchange in an entire increasingly commodity-oriented society. I think more importantly, it tried to accord to each and every one who wanted the power to be the artist, the giver who gives the most and who does obligate the others. I mean, that's essentially the role, the symbolical role of the artist, somebody who gives the essential gift that exceeds all expectations and that doesn't have a price, but of course have a price after all. So it's a kind of social impossibility, if there ever was one. And perhaps the purest expression of the avant-garde dream of an existence beyond social division. And as mentioned before, it's a kind of dream you can find, for instance, in the work also of Joseph Beuys or in any of the ideas of collective art practices and so on, getting rid of your artistic signature, anonymity, lack of authority and so on. I think you all know these things quite well. But the constant policing of ethical rules that supports the dreams of this social impossibility, of course, also cast long shadows of the unspoken social obligations and power relations inherent in the male art system. So if the dream of the male art system managed to live on despite these contradictions, it's probably because of the fact that the fragility of this utopianism is somehow covered up by the efficiency and apparent pragmatism of the medium that gives the male art movement its shape, notably the postal system, for the attempt to democratize or generalize the ability to give, to be the giver, the sender, the author, in a sense, could perhaps only be imagined on a large scale through a medium that is proper to modern democracy, and that shapes all of its subjects into both senders, givers, and receivers. So the modern postal system is precisely the medium that makes this dream possible. And the central role played by the postal system in this context, I think, is supported by the fact that the explicit discourse of the male art movement, it's not so much focused on gifts and giving as on the concept of communication, the concept of understanding and love and so on. So a discourse that's proper to the pragmatics of the postal medium, but essentially, I think, expressive of the longing that fuels the movement, the longing for the restoration of lost social unity, sealed with the big gift, the biggest gift of all, the gift of art. At least the biggest gift of all in secular societies that have lost their ritual forms of sacrification and so on. Sacrifice, I'm sorry. Now, the little note that I started out with for this lecture, from That's the Worst of All Days, August 8, 1965, contains no reference to this particular type of sociality. It expresses longing, yes, but only in terms of the strictly personal. It attests to the systemic nature of the postal system, but never as a productive framework for a utopian mode of governance. And in fact, I think that Ray Johnson's own particular use of the postal system is a very strange and double-edged kind of performance. For right from the start, it seems to completely undercut, to completely undermine every single one of the social ideals and achievements of this huge male art movement that he seemed to engender, that his art seemed to have initiated. And in fact, he would through his career, have a very ambivalent relationship with the international male art movement. It was not a question of just seeing this as his big creation or something that he would simply identify with. And yet, it is precisely in this double capacity, with and against the postal, the male art system, that his take on the postal manages to frame the ambivalences of a 20th century art system suspended between formalist visual practices and social ideals. This is like the tension field, I think, in modern art, running from early 20th century art through today's practice. So it's interesting to note then that in the mailing network conceived by Ray Johnson, the discourse of gifts and giving becomes the vehicle through which a reflection on the postal system itself, a very critical reflection, in fact, becomes possible. Not just an utopian ideal reflection, not just the use of the postal system to create love and communion, but a thinking about what is this modernity that is structured through the postal system. And I'll get now to work that I think can maybe say a few things about this. This is a letter, not written by Ray Johnson. In 1958, Ray Johnson received a letter from a grateful recipient of a gift of one of his works. He had been sending a probably beautiful little collage to a certain Frédéric Saint-Aubin. Now you can picture Ray Johnson receiving this letter and then sitting down at his table, his working table, writing between the lines of this letter, interrupting almost every single statement of gratitude in this letter. And he's interrupting all these statements of gratitude with his own rather acerbic, ironic, and kind of cutting commentaries. And after he's done that, after he's written between the lines of this letter, undermining all the expressions of gratitude, he takes this thing, this overwritten letter, and sends it not back to the original letter writer, but to a third party, notably his friend William S. Wilson, also known as Bill Wilson. So if he writes, I didn't remember, and then Ray writes, forgot to remember, and so on, that you gave to me. Did I give you anything? Was it me? Was it me? It's like that all the time. He completely destroys the idea that there's any kind of relation here. So to retrace a little bit the steps here, this Frédéric Saint-Aubin has received a work of art from Ray Johnson. And he is fully aware of the value of the gift he has received. A work of art belongs to that particular type of gift that can be categorized as invaluable, meaning that they are supposedly outside of the ordinary forms of economic speculation that always threaten to turn gift-giving into a more dignified and symbol-enhanced form of trade. I mean, it's always the problem with gifts. They must appear as gifts and not as mere kind of trading. That's very important. Yet works of art are, as we all know, also the objects of intense economic speculation, based on which the way in precisely their status as invaluable may, at some unpredictable moment in the future, who knows, be translated into pure cash value. We just saw the examples now at Sotheby's 2 days ago with Giacometti's going at unheard prices and also a lot of other things just going through the roof. So a work of art could then perhaps be called the essential gift, at least from an anthropological perspective, which pays attention to the way in which in every known culture the gift must always appear to exceed the economic framework, the framework of trading, sale, exchange, etc., at the same time as they establish relations of debt or credit which serve to reinforce or redistribute the power relations in that particular economy. Now, you see the duplicity of gift here. Outside of trade, insider trade. Because of this gift, a deep relation has now been created between this letter writer, Saint-Aubin, and the giver, Ray Johnson. And this is why he's very, very polite and effusive in this letter. A mere thank you is not enough. He really has to speak about it. He now remembers an early work by Johnson, and that's centered on a mutual interest, and that somehow proves that the two of them are now spiritually connected and so on. And now that there is a relation, he wants to see Ray Johnson and his more of his work again, etc. And there's nothing extraordinary about this exchange. It's entirely normal politeness, very, you know, warm politeness, but still normal politeness. So what is extraordinary here is Ray Johnson's response to this letter, which is nothing less than a complete dismissal of the whole idea that the gift has been given. Complete dismissal. And this dismissal has nothing to do with the kind of politeness back when you give a gift and somebody says thank you and you say, oh, no, no, that's nothing. It's not that. It's really, there is no relation. There may be a relation, but there is no relation. There is a relation, there isn't a relation here. So Johnson's writing between the lines systematically pinches and probes every single element in Saint-Aubin's letter that supports the logic of gifts and giving. That is the notion that one person can in fact give something to another person. So what is questioned here or opened up is one, the idea of the identity of the giver who is given something, the identification between the gift and the giver, the notion of property, what's yours, what's mine, etc., the notion of a proper reception of the gift, the idea of politeness, etc., the moment of exchange, when this happened, this idea of a time of giving, and the narrative structure, the story about you and me, that supports the whole framework of giving. I mean, that's very important. You gave to me, I gave to you, etc. We now have a bond. There's a story of that. That's history writing in its pure essence. So the important thing here is that this letter that Ray Johnson overwrites, it's not sent back to Saint-Aubin, but to a third person. So the relation is dispersed, transformed, changed. It's a kind of redistribution that breaks open this bilateral relation between the giver and the recipient that Saint-Aubin's thank you letter works so hard to affirm. Now, this 1958 letter, and it's just a piece of ephemera among the thousands of Ray Johnson mailings that are dispersed all over the world, presents a model, I think a very important model, a model of the structure of his postal performance. And through this, also, a different model of what is usually imagined as the social dynamics of communication arts. For if Johnson interrupts the very ground of the gift logic that subtends Saint-Aubin's letter, it affects also, and this is important, Ray Johnson's own practice of giving, which was developed in the most literal sense of the word through the medium of the postal system with its limitless network of givers and receivers. I mean, Ray Johnson started this. He started as a giver, and now suddenly he says, I'm not giving. You haven't received. There's no relation. So you see there's a double thing going on here. This is getting right back to himself. And then it will necessarily affect, I think, all the terms and all the ideals that would come to surround what was later called correspondence art or mail art. The idea of art as communication, as an act of ritual generosity, of art as social networking, and last but not least, the new ideal of democratic participation in the arts. Anybody can be an artist. Anybody can be a giver. We can all participate. We all know this. This is the idea in museums these days, that we can all interact with and, in fact, be creative with the works and so on. So Ray Johnson's system would seem to support these things, but, in fact, he cuts it off at the moment that he establishes all of that. So I think it's significant that at the end of this strange response to Saint-Aubin, and you can see something that's written in small print at the very bottom of the letter, there is a little sentence that where Ray Johnson reflects more deeply, I think, on the complexities of giving. And this is addressed to his friend Bill, who receives this. And he's, Bill, there is that moment in giving. It has nothing to do with what or how, to whom or why. It's the same as any other moment. Since it does not exist, it escapes and is not seen. We contain it by description, actions, realization, Ray. Now, this additional note actually seems to engage head-on with the complex question of the timing of gifts or giving that is at the core of some of the most influential discussions of the function of gifts within social system. In the work of anthropologist Marcel Mauss, the discussion of the role of the gift within the perspective of what he called the total social fact, the timing of the gift, the time of the gift is what distinguishes it from mere exchange or from mere trade. Gifts are ruled by a time limit that determines that if you want to respond to the gift, if you want to give something back, it can only be after a certain time. If you give back immediately, then it's trade. If you get a gift, you must wait quite a long while, and then you can give something back. Then it's a gift. I think we all know that. We know this system quite well. So, in his rereading of Marcel Mauss' interpretation of the gift and its importance for social relations, the French philosopher Jacques Derrida focuses on Mauss' notion of this time limit as the symptom of the exclusionary mechanisms of a sociological language that makes social totality or the social itself an object of description or definition, as if it was a category, as if the social simply exists like an object that you can just look at and treat like that. For such time limits are invariably understood in terms of the fullness of presence, and will then only serve to testify to the eternal cycle of meaningful exchanges that subtends this notion of the social as an object, something that's given, that's actually there. And guarantees, in fact, the idea of returns and responses, responsibility, all these things that go with that. Now, Derrida's own effort to think the time limit of the gift in other terms is quite important here. It tries to think of it also as a sort of non-presence in a way which is kind, I think, analogous with what Ray Johnson does here. Something that doesn't exist, that's somehow strange, mad, inconceivable, you can't understand it, making the gift in fact strange and impossible. For what would the excessive and non-economic force of the gift be if it could simply be communicated, recognized, inscribed, traded, understood as such? From this perspective, Derrida's perspective, and I think also Ray Johnson's perspective, the gift does not guarantee that there is such a thing as social relations, does not guarantee that there is such a thing as the social. It's rather a kind of strange, duplicitous force that seems to destroy the circle of social exchanges, just as it also frames and encircles the social. So it's a strange, complicated thing. And it's something having more to do with a force to all the time renew, open up again, the possibility of something social, not just affirming its existence as such. So the phenomenon of gift, you know, deeply, absolutely cross-cultural phenomenon, may above all, I think, direct our attention to the eventual becoming of the social, the possible becoming of the social, not its existence as something absolutely there, tangible, etc. I just want to show you this strange gift that Ray Johnson gave to Lamont Young, and which consists of all these packages with all these envelopes, and all these envelopes contain dates. So there's a timing of the gift that's infused by zillion times, so many times you can hardly count. And each within each of these envelopes, there are tiny little fragments of something that you might call a collage if you want. And there's a whole system for how you can interact with that and deal with that. But it's above all a gift given for a specific date, but that contains so many times, an excessive time, if you want. Now, when Ray Johnson brings up the question of the potential lack of reality of the moment of giving, he contributes to reorient our conception of the social in precisely the way indicated by Derrida's thinking also, I think. And the postal system, which automatically provides the time delays necessary to make responses appear as spontaneous or unexpected gifts. Wow, a letter in the box today. My God, that was unexpected. Seems to presuppose the never-ending presence of a sociality that never fails to stay connected in a kind of continual and authentic communication above and beyond all forms of antagonism and misunderstanding, etc. To point out then the uncertain reality of the moments of exchange that keeps the system going is then also to point to the losses, dispersals, strayings, misreadings that necessarily inhabits such a system and that threatens it from within. But most importantly, it points out that the prevalent impulse to change the terms of art production from the formal to the social, that is to consciously produce artworks as gifts or moments of authentic communication, is not a guarantee of any access to the reality of the social as such. I think Ray Johnson, in fact, criticizes, undermines a lot of the more naive ideas of producing the social through art by exactly accessing the social in a sense. So at the time, the 1960s, when the notion of the social was about to be raised to a principle in the work of a number of artists related to performance, to happenings, to new forms of collective art practices, Johnson refuses, it seems to me, to see it as a category that modern art can simply latch onto when tired of its own formalism, its own devalued or overvalued forms. If something like the social does exist in his work, it is only as something extremely elusive, almost non-existent, impossible to just grasp in the here and now. The utopian dream of sociality, of connection, is certainly there, and the longing for the ecstasies of authentic communication and the erotics of the actual contact between bodies is suggestively staged, I think, in terms of the idea of an ever-expanding social network and all these dramas of what do I receive? Do I receive anything? Nothing today, horrors, all these things. But it is as if this dream can only be fulfilled through a strategy that continually undoes the bonds that these networks were supposed to reinforce. So as Johnson's postal performance plays up the effects of miscommunication and antagonism at the very scene of social bonding, it becomes clear that authentic communication, if it happens at all, happens at a different speed, the speed of becoming, the speed of possibility. It is, in other words, a performance devoted not to the reality of the social in art, but to the strange, crazy strategies of initiating sociality anew. And how do you do that? Is it possible at all? I think it's above all linked to a certain philosophy, a certain other way of thinking about the social that I think undermines some of the presuppositions of normal sociology, but can be linked to certain other traditions in philosophy and in emergent sociology, and I'll talk about that now here at the end. But first, this strange, almost non-existent take on the social, I think that has a lot to do with the fact that in the work of Ray Johnson, the identities of senders and receivers increasingly seem to take on a very strange double status. As a technology for governing, the modern system, as I said initially, is based on the stability of proper names and addresses. I mean, if you change your name, you change your address, you don't get your mail. I mean, that's simple as that. So if you want your mail to come, you keep your name, you keep your address, or you keep the system informed. In Ray Johnson's work, the proper names increasingly seem to both work and not work. The proper names in the modern postal system essentially support what Ernest de Laclau and Chantal Mouffe has called a political imaginary peopled with universal subjects conceptually built around the idea of one big history. But, and then also one big idea of the social, but in Johnson's postal system, the social space of actual addressees is doubled by a sort of ecstatic space, a poetic space, I would even say, where a profusion of proper names, and proper names of actually existing persons, seem to float around as if disconnected. For the names of the participants in his mailing system no longer occupied only the space in envelopes and letterheads, they seem to more and more become the very content of mailings and messages themselves. So he has the system of senders and receivers. There are envelopes, names on envelopes being sent to concrete people. But all these names seem to exist on a level of poetic resonances within his sendings and mailings themselves and within his collages, within his imagery. So there's a whole poetics of flickering, floating names and the resonances of names and the transformations of names, of proper names and addresses throughout his work. So I think you can see a quite good example in this work where there's a lot of play here in this message on the work of Jill Cornbley, Jill Bourne and Klee and so on. And then suddenly there, Mr. Paul Klee and so on. So that's a typical thing. And this is on an envelope where there is one addressee, except it's called Ray Jolly Son instead of Ray Johnson, and a lot of other messy things happening. And suddenly he seems to write letters to somebody called Dear Edge. And what would that be if not the question of the edge of paintings, which was a big, big theme in 1960s formalist art. So suddenly paintings become like proper names and subjects that can be addressed. So there's there this and there that. And there are like collages like this written to maybe there that Jasper Johns, but also there's zillion names all through this work. It's a very typical type of work from him. So here, these names take part in a complex and exhausting naming game that continually subjects the name to kind of pseudonymy, cryptonymy, palynymy, metonymy, also anonymity. In fact, all the bad things that can happen to a name, all the accidents that can happen to a name. So how to address this kind of ecstatic, poetic name community of destroyed names, a community that doesn't simply exist, but that is continually being invented in Ray Johnson's collages. And how to understand a community that exists not in terms of postal connections or communications, but also through a postal principle of disconnection, bifurcation, uncontrollable spreading. In fact, a kind of sociality that can only be approached in terms of what Ray Johnson called collage analysis. This was the name he used for what he did to the letter, the nice letter of Frédéric Saint-Aubin. He said, I have to make this thing go through a collage analysis. So here seems to be something like a methodology, a way of approaching the social true collage analysis. And this is quite interesting to me because there are, in fact, correspondences here, similarities with other forms of sociology, other forms of thinking the social that completely distances themselves from the idea that the social is a fact out there that we simply study. And I do not want to conclude absolutely here. I just want to bring this reference up for thinking. Suggest a model or direction for understanding this non-objectivizing way of working with social, the social in art. And the model here that we may perhaps think a little bit about is Bruno Latour's totally different concept of sociology, based on the theories of a long-forgotten 19th century sociologist called Gabriel Tarde. And the first thing that characterizes this strange sociology is that it completely does away with the idea of the social as a field or a domain. As Latour puts it, the social in normal sociology is always kind of expressed as a domain of reality, a specific domain of reality that always kind of envelopes, encompasses the agents that are inside it, and that's used as a kind of explanation force to talk about everything that is not proper to the various fields that are within the social. So, for instance, talking about art, there's a lot of things that we say these problems belong to art proper. And then there are kind of limit phenomena of art that we say have more to do with social problems. And that's that we can go to take that model from a number of different other fields, law, psychology, etc. So social scientists have managed to make this definition of society as a kind of the big context that everything takes place within, as a kind of default position referred to by all other disciplines and agents as well. It's a little bit problematic, isn't it? And that is why I think it's perhaps time to think about these things one more time. And I think Ray Johnson presents another model. And the idea here, which is quite interesting, is a concept of associations. Because Latour, with Gabriel Tarde, says that in order to think sociology, or to think the social not as a domain, a field, a context, then you can try to think through the social as a system of associations. So Latour presents the contours of such an opening when he contrasts what he calls Durkheim's sociology of the social with a small subfield now called the sociology of associations, but we could see as a kind of collage sociology. Gabriel Tarde thought of the social not as a field or domain, but as a kind of circulating fluid that should be followed by new methods. And the social is here, for Tarde, is not a thing. It's a principle of connectivity between things that are not in themselves social. So for sociology, the focus might then be on the ever new configurations or associations between things, new assemblages of elements. And this might seem like a very kind of vague proposition compared with the relative fixity of the notion of the social domain or context. But Latour argues, and I think quite convincingly, that the principle of connectivity, such a principle of connectivity, lies in fact behind the most common experiences that we have in encountering what he calls the puzzling face of the social. And I just give you a quote here. Towards the very end here. A new vaccine is being marketed. A new job description is offered, a new political movement is being created, a new planetary system is discovered, a new law is voted, a new catastrophe occurs. In each instance, we have to reshuffle our conceptions of what was associated together because the previous definition has been made somewhat irrelevant. Thus, the overall project of what we are supposed to be doing together is thrown into doubt. The sense of belonging has entered the crisis. But to register this feeling of crisis and to follow these new connections, another notion of the social has to be devised. It has to be much wider than what is usually called by that name, yet strictly limited to the tracing of new associations and to the designing of assemblages. Now, I think perhaps a similar principle may be at work in the postal operations of Ray Johnson. Using the operations of 20th century visual art as a point of departure for moving through and then beyond the concept of postal connection and communication, Ray Johnson's collage analysis is ultimately, I think, nothing less than an outline for a new ontology of the social itself.